Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and at 14 hours GMT on Monday, the 23rd of March, these are our main stories. Italy tightens its lockdown despite a decrease in death toll from the coronavirus. Australia and Canada say they won't compete in the Tokyo Olympics. And the head of the OECD warns that the global economy will suffer for years to come from the pandemic. Also in this podcast, a man in Taiwan is fined for ignoring a coronavirus quarantine to visit a nightclub and the human jukebox.
It was really quite heartwarming. It was extraordinary to see that connectivity, and the first Saturday night in, people were looking for something to do, and it was extraordinary to be able to be a small provider of that.
The singer trying to cheer people up from his room in times of isolation. To Italy first, which accounts for more than a third of global deaths from the coronavirus. There was another huge jump in the number of fatalities on Sunday, more than 650. But there is a glimmer of hope, because that figure was 140 lower than on Saturday. Health official Franco Locatelli says it could be a sign that Italy's drastic containment measures are beginning to work.
We obviously do not want to get caught up in premature enthusiasm, let alone overinterpret this trend. But undoubtedly, we welcome this positive signal because we're reaching the point where we expect to see tangible signs about the effectiveness of the confinement measures that have been taken.
Nevertheless, Italy has now tightened restrictions further, as Oliver Conway heard from Mark Lowen in Rome.
Well, the decree signed by the Prime Minister now means that all businesses that are deemed not essential for national production are to close, Ollie. That includes anything that is not making, for example, food or pharmaceuticals or the oil industry. So there are exceptions, of course. For example, veterinary clinics can remain open. Factories that are making parts for transport can remain open. But this is intended to try to close more businesses, significantly more businesses that are currently open. Also, Italians are now banned from travelling within the country, leaving their own comune, which is roughly equivalent to a town or a municipality. And in Lombardy, which is the region in northern Italy that is the worst hit, you can no longer exercise on your own, for example. You can't go out for a run. Even in Rome, it's becoming more difficult, I have to say. I mean, I went out for a much-needed run yesterday, Sunday, and I was stopped by police and told that I was too far away from my neighbourhood and that I could only exercise within a 300-metre distance of my home. So they are trying to tighten things even further, and I have to say that there is general support for that from the Italian population, because they see that potentially the restrictions are beginning to bear fruit in terms of the slowest rise in new infections now since the outbreak began.
And do people go outside at all, or are they just staying at home?
They do. I mean, there are not that many people outside, and most of them tend to have either masks or gloves. But I mean, people go out to go to work. They come back from work. They go to the supermarket. The lines, the queues outside the supermarket are they're not huge, but they're orderly. People are let in one by one. They still go out to walk their dogs. But I mean, there are many more police checkpoints now than there have been. And police cars roaming around, basically asking people why they're out. It's all sort of very eerie and sort of reminiscent of kind of wartime occupation curfews, something that Italy hasn't seen for decades. But as I say, there is not opposition to it. In fact, on the contrary, there is a feeling that the tightness of the restrictions should have been maybe imposed even earlier.
And how are the hospitals coping? Because they were said to be under incredible strain.
They still are. I mean, when you're seeing, 651 deaths in between Saturday and Sunday, that just tells you just how huge the outbreak still is. I mean, we're still seeing 5,500 new cases, 5,500 total cases every day. So intensive care units in the north particularly are nearing capacity, and the hospital, the doctors there are severely under strain. I mean, 14 doctors in Italy have now died from the outbreak, so that is very high in comparison to China, for example, and they are really desperate. They're setting up intensive care units wherever they can, in corridors, in emergency tents and structures, and they are getting help now from other countries. So Russia has sent in medics and equipment, as well as Cuba and China, because Italy simply can't cope on its own.
That was Mark Lowen in Rome. Crowds flocked to see the Olympic flame on display in Japan over the weekend, but as we record this podcast, it's looking increasingly likely that the 2020 Tokyo Olympics will be postponed because of the pandemic. The Games have been due to start on July the 24th, but countries such as Australia and Canada have already said they won't compete, and now the Tokyo Olympics chief and the country's Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, say they are considering it.
I want to implement the Olympics and Paralympics completely as proof that the world has overcome the virus, which the international community is now severely affected by. If it is difficult to do so, we will have to think first about athletes and make a decision about whether to postpone the event.
The words of the Japanese Prime Minister. Oliver Conway spoke to our sports news correspondent, Alex Capstick.
It's looking increasingly inevitable that the Games will be delayed in some form, especially now that that option is one the Japanese organisers have admitted that they're looking into. The Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's comments confirming what has been a shift in momentum regarding the delay of Tokyo 2020 over the past few days. The IOC President Thomas Bach, he wrote a letter to athletes over the weekend in which he talked about the dilemma they are in. He says they need a maximum of 4 weeks to come up with a definitive answer, but he's under pressure to offer clarity sooner rather than later. That's because Canada and Australia have warned they won't send a team to Tokyo unless it's postponed for a year. They said holding the Games as planned would threaten the health of their athletes. Olympic committees in Norway and Brazil, they've also requested a postponement. And significantly, the head of World Athletics, Sebastian Coe, this is one of the major sports at the Summer Olympics. He's written to Thomas Bach, making it clear his desire for the event to be moved. He said an Olympic Games this year is neither feasible or desirable, again citing the health of the athletes, but also that their lack of training opportunities and competition would make it an unfair a competition in Tokyo. The question now, I think, is not whether it will go ahead on July the 24th, but how long it will be delayed for.
Yeah, and that is a difficult one because Japan's invested a lot of time, energy and money in this. The head of the Japanese Olympic Committee saying too long a delay would be a burden to athletes preparing. I mean, what can you do?
Well, yeah, I think part of the reason that this has taken a few weeks to get to this point is because Japan so desperately wants to host these games. The country has ploughed billions of dollars into the project. Everything is ready. The IOC has lavished praise on the preparations. The torch relay is due to begin its journey around Japan on Thursday. A postponement would have financial consequences. Many of the facilities, including the athletes' village, may have been contracted out once the games are due to finish. So those sort of deals would have to be renegotiated or alternatives found. And also remember, this is a massive opportunity to show off what Japan has achieved. Tokyo last hosted the Games back in 1964, which symbolised the country's recovery from war. When Tokyo won the right to host the 2020 edition, the Games were seen as a springboard for another recovery, this one following the devastating tsunami and earthquake of 2011. So it would be a massive disappointment for the Japanese people if the Games were to be moved. But crucially, they're not talking about a cancellation.
That was Alex Capstick. Across South America, governments have been closing borders and shutting down public places. While there aren't the number of coronavirus cases that have been seen in Europe, the fear is that this deeply unequal region won't be able to cope if the virus spreads further. Our South America correspondent Katie Watson is in Brazil's biggest city, Sao Paulo, home to the highest number of cases in the region so far.
Every Brazilian, big and small, is having to relearn the art of saying hello. Sitting around a circle in their classroom last week,
just before schools were shut down. These kids were being asked by teacher Camila to come up with their own new ways of greeting family and friends.
It's very difficult for us because Brazilian people, they like to hug and kiss each other every day. So we have to tell kids every day not to kiss and hug, and then they gave us solutions to make hearts and to kiss far from each other. And they realized the importance of this changing greetings.
Across town at Hospital das Clínicas, Latin America's biggest, it's full-on crisis mode. The emergency and disaster team is having a meeting. 20 or so doctors sat around a table, and they're discussing all the precautions they can take so that this epidemic works through in a better way than we've seen in other countries.
Por isso que a gente vai usar esse andar inteiro, esse rosa aqui é o nosso elevador.
Dr. Perondi heads up the team. They're blocking off an entire floor for patients to avoid any risk of the virus spreading.
Provavelmente nas primeiras duas semanas nós vamos estar enchendo isso daqui.
In 2 weeks, she thinks half of this new ward will be full. In a month, there won't be any beds left.
Here in São Paulo, we don't have enough intensive care beds. That's a fact. There are already people waiting for them, and that's our worry, because we're at more than 100% occupancy. So just imagine what happens when that number rises.
The lab downstairs is testing both patients and hospital workers, and the government says it'll provide up to 10 million rapid tests in the coming weeks to stop the spread of COVID-19. Up until now, doctors say that coronavirus has been an upper-middle-class concern here. Wealthy people, for the most part, coming back from holidays abroad and getting seen to in private hospitals. The concern now, though, is that as this virus is starting to move within the community, what will that mean in poorer neighbourhoods with difficult living conditions? And how fast will the virus spread? One such neighbourhood is Parque Novo Santa Amaro, in the south of Sao Paulo. In this rundown favela, the music's still blaring, and the kids are still playing outside. 29-year-old Bianca Santana runs a manicure salon inside her home, not that she has customers at the moment. She shows me the open sewer that runs right outside her front door. Clean water here is never guaranteed in these parts of Brazil. The water and sewage that runs through this favela absolutely stinks. It's running brown, grey. There's also red water coming out from one of the pipes. And every few minutes you see a rat pop out on top of the broken chairs and televisions and old pots and clothes that have all been dumped here, right in the middle of the community.
As preocupações assim, porque chega muita informação.
Bianca says there's lots of fake news circulating and nobody's come to talk to them about coronavirus. Many here just don't understand the threat. And if somebody tests positive and has to quarantine, virtually impossible when families of 10 are living in a tiny flat.
Katie Watson reporting from Sao Paulo. The authorities in Taiwan have issued a $33,000 fine to a man who ignored a coronavirus quarantine order to visit a crowded nightclub. Celia Hatton has the story.
Police in Taiwan were conducting a surprise check on the patrons of a nightclub in the capital, Taipei, in the early hours on Sunday morning when they discovered a man named Mr. Huang, who was supposed to be at home observing a 14-day quarantine. He'd recently returned from Southeast Asia. Officials decided he deserved the maximum fine for violating his quarantine order because he was discovered inside an enclosed space. Taipei's mayor said Mr. Huang's partying was a malicious act. Taiwan has received global praise for its tough but transparent virus control measures.
That was Celia Hatton. Now, ever since the crisis started, we've been seeing images of people around the world wearing face masks, either to try to protect themselves or ensure that they aren't spreading germs themselves. Now, more than ever, people are wearing them when venturing outside and even in public indoor spaces. So just how effective are they? The BBC's been broadcasting a series of short features about the issue of social distancing, hygiene measures and the use of face masks. Here's Dr. Shanmei Young of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine.
One of the reasons that people wear masks is they think that it's going to protect them from virus. But the virus isn't floating around in the air, so it's not protecting me against anything because it's not there. It's probably going to be on my hand, because I've shaken hands with someone who's got the virus and I have transmitted it. I have carried the virus to my face. If you're in an environment where everybody else is wearing a face mask and you're not, then it may make you feel vulnerable because you feel like you don't have the protection everyone else does. But logically, if you're not close to people, they're not coughing and sneezing on you, then a face mask isn't necessary. The virus enters the body through mucous membranes. We mean the eyes, the nose, the mouth, and it transmits from person to person, generally by us touching our eyes, nose or mouth, or if we're inhaling droplets directly from someone who is sneezing or coughing. The best way for the general public to protect itself against coronavirus and other respiratory viruses is really careful hand hygiene, so that's really washing your hands with either soap and water or alcohol gel if soap and water is not available, especially when you think that you've been exposed. So if you've been out in public places and touching kind of surfaces that other people might have touched. One of the problems, if lots of people who don't need face masks are using face masks or stockpiling them, it means that there aren't enough face masks available where they're really needed for people like healthcare workers who are on the front line and dealing with suspect or confirmed coronavirus cases. The vast majority of people are not susceptible to getting a severe infection. For most people, it will be a mild illness, like having a cold or a cough or the flu. It's the older people with comorbidities who are at risk, so you don't need to go and panic buy face masks.
Dr. Shanmei Leung from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Still to come, when a wildlife sanctuary closes due to coronavirus.
I had the idea to start with was because I just didn't want to not come into work, to not be able to help and feed the animals, but I also didn't want to bring anything back home.
The keeper who's moved in to keep the animals company. Despite efforts by governments around the world to reduce the economic impacts of coronavirus, with huge rescue packages, stock markets around the world are continuing to fall. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which brings together developed economies, says a huge coordinated effort is needed to stop the coronavirus pandemic causing a long global recession. The head of the OECD, Angel Juria, said the work needed to be on an unprecedented scale, dwarfing the Marshall Plan that rebuilt Europe's economies after the Second World War. He warned that many countries could face one of the worst economic recessions in years.
If you don't get a worldwide recession, you're going to get either no growth or negative growth in many of the economies of the world, including some of the larger ones, and therefore you're going to get not only low growth for this year, but also you will leave a sequel that will be affecting us for, unfortunately, a few years to come.
Oliver Conway heard more about the market falls from our international business correspondent, Theo Leggett.
If you think about why people invest in shares in the first place, it's because they're gambling that the company they're investing in is going to make money, is going to make profits, and that some of that profit will be returned to shareholders through dividends, and that at the same time, the money they invest will be reasonably safe. Now, at the moment, all bets are off. Businesses that would ordinarily be doing business and making money are having to shut down, and nobody knows how long for. And in that environment, investors are quite horrified. They're looking at this and thinking, well, where can I put my money? I'd better take my money out. There are some people, of course, who make money off a falling market, but the general picture is if companies aren't making money, then there's less reason to invest in them, and investors are running scared.
And do the falls on the stock market itself actually affect ordinary people?
Well, yes, they can. So, for example, if your pension is invested in the stock market, as many people's are here in the UK and also in the United States, then it's very worrying if you're reaching the end of your working life and you want to cash in your pension fund and take an annuity or something like that, because the return that you'll get will be a lot less than it would have been had you cashed it in just a few months ago. If you look at the FTSE 100 share index, for example, it's gone down by about 28% over the past few weeks. So these are big, big falls. Now, obviously, we're seeing action by governments and by central banks to try to stimulate the economy, but that is the wider economy. That's trying to help people who are losing wages, trying to help businesses that have no income but have debts to stay operating. So that's trying to address problems in the real economy, but it isn't yet feeding through to the share markets because people see no reason to invest in these companies right now.
And briefly, when experts talk about a U-shaped recovery rather than a V-shaped recovery, they just mean it's going to take a long time.
Well, basically, yes, a V-shaped recovery is you can have a rapid decline in growth followed by a rapid recovery. A U-shaped recovery means that you go down, you bump along the bottom for quite a lot longer before you start coming up. So, yes, it's a slower recovery, I'm afraid.
That was Theo Leggett. Medical and aid workers in northwestern Syria are braced for the worst after the first case of coronavirus was officially confirmed in the war-torn country. Sebastian Usher reports.
There have been unconfirmed reports for several weeks of coronavirus in Syria, but the lack of testing had made it hard to be sure. With the first confirmed case, the prospect of the virus spreading through a country devastated by 9 years of war is now a reality. The government has closed down schools and public meeting places. Roads are being disinfected. Even bread will be delivered rather than available in bakeries. But the biggest fear is for the areas where the conflict is still raging, Idlib in particular. There, hundreds of thousands of displaced people are already suffering from lack of shelter and medical support.
That was Sebastian Usher. When a wildlife sanctuary is forced to close to the public and needs to keep its own staff safe from the virus, who looks after the animals? At Paradise Park in Cornwall, in the southwest of the UK, three of the keepers have moved in to look after everything from parrots to red pandas and Asian otters. Michelle Hussein spoke to Izzy Wheatley, who's one of the keepers.
Funnily enough, I had the idea at home, and as I came in to tell my boss, they were all talking about it as well. There was a house on site that the family who originally owned the park were living in, and so it was all set up and ready. It's often used for conservation meetings as well when people have to come from abroad, and it was actually set up for the Operation Chuff meeting, which was happening in the next couple of days. So it was all ready to go, and we were moved in by the next day.
Oh, so it's already happened?
Yes, we've already been here two nights.
How many different species, how many living creatures in total will you be looking after?
So individuals at the park, we've got under just 1,200, which is around 120 different species.
So how difficult a task is that going to be for just three of you?
It's going to be a very difficult task. We are putting in place trying to come in early to chop up fruit or to set out bowls. And obviously we're trying to have minimal contact with each other, which is very hard doing our job because it is all teamwork, basically, very close contact teamwork. So we are putting measures in place that some can come in early and leave early.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that. So there's three of you in total. You'll all be living in the same house.
Yes.
But keeping a distance from each other.
Yes, that's the hard bit. And then we're making extra sure because we do have still keepers coming in at the moment from outside. And so obviously they'll be going back to their families and partners. So we need to make sure we're taking extra caution when it comes to those.
And what about those you've left? I'm rather assuming you don't normally live on site, do you?
No.
You don't?
No.
Okay, so what about your family? What do they think of this?
Well, I normally live at home. I've got quite a big family. There's seven of us. And so my mum is actually at quite high risk. So the main reason I had the idea to start with was because I just didn't want to not come into work, to not be able to help and feed the animals. But I also didn't want to bring anything back home. So we're all trying to keep as safe as distance as we can.
And how difficult do you think it will be? I mean, obviously, you've got a big task in terms of the numbers of animals and birds you'll be looking after. But
we do.
Given that you said, you know, how much you do normally work in teams, how hard is it going to be to do what you need to do and not be able to call on your colleague to do something with you or to do it with you at a distance?
It is going to be extremely hard. We are obviously having to put on hold some of the bigger maintenance jobs, which would involve a lot more keepers. So we're coming in and we're setting out food separately and then feeding. It is already split into smaller sections. So we don't need to go round together originally for those bits, which is great. And so we can carry on that as normal. And we're all separate sides of the park feeding individual animals.
That was Izzy Wheatley, who is a zookeeper in Cornwall. Now, according to a tally kept by the AFP news agency, 1 billion people around the world have now been told to stay at home because of the virus. You might remember I asked you for your tips on keeping your spirits up in isolation, and we will be sharing your wisdom in coming podcasts. Here's the first one.
Hello from Toronto, Canada. My name is Lila Vialli, and I am a longtime listener and fan of the BBC Global News podcast. And my advice to keep your spirits high and your sanity in check during this unprecedented time is to fill your space with music from around the world. Choose songs you know and love, or maybe try something new to spice things up. I think I'm a little bit biased because I make music for a living, but I think music goes a really long way to warm a space and add a little variety to the day, no matter where you are.
Thank you, Lila. Keep yours coming and share the wisdom of the Global News podcast family. And Lila's advice chimes with quite a lot of people. Musicians and artists are finding some very ingenious ways of performing to the public. Mark Randall is a Frank Sinatra impersonator who was due to play the lead role in a London production. But that and his other regular shows have all been cancelled. So on Saturday night, he became the human jukebox, taking singing requests from an online audience.
Oh, the shark, babe, has such teeth, dear. And it shows them pearly white.
I was due to do a gig at a local working men's club in Bletchley. And then this thing happened, and it looked like people were still taking the self-isolation thing seriously. I got in touch with the club, and they said, yeah, we're not actually going to open. So I thought, well, OK, what can I do then? And I just had the idea of doing stuff on Facebook Live. And so I thought, well, I'll do a gig from my flat in Leighton Buzzard and put it on Facebook Live and see what happens. I had nothing else to do. I had the gear in the back of the car, and so I ordered some slash curtain from Amazon. And so I did it. I just set it up and told a few friends about it and did it just like as if it was a gig. It seemed like entering into a strange new world for the very first time, for the very first kind of Saturday night without a night out.
And this is one where we might have to change the lyrics in the age of COVID-19 when it gets to the hands, touching hands bit. You know what I mean? Because, well, use the sanitizer, wash your hands.
Very quickly, the numbers built up, and you could see a tally of the numbers in the top left-hand corner. If you've got your glasses on and you can read it that small. I mean, there was a woman from Las Vegas who I'd worked with 15 years ago. She kind of came up and said hi. My sister in Australia popped up, and then my family who were in Wales were waving or sending a thumbs up. It was really quite heartwarming. It was extraordinary to see that connectivity, and the first Saturday night in, people were looking for something to do, and it was extraordinary to be able to be a small provider of that. And the great thing is that I don't have 84 empty bottles to take to the bin, or, you know, there's no dog ends outside the back door where people have been smoking. There's no tidying up to do. It seemed suddenly important that we maintain those connections in these times when we're all being told to stay at home. It seemed very, very important to reach out and have that personal connection, because suddenly we're in this situation that none of us as human beings have ever been in before. We are going to be in a really bad way at the end of all this when they finally let us out again into pubs and clubs. We're not going to quite have survived, I think, socially. Sweet Caroline.
And that was Mark Randall. That's it from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you'd like to comment on this podcast or the topics we've covered in it, or you would like to share your top tips for keeping it together in isolation, or you have questions about the coronavirus, just send us an email. You know the address by now. It's globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.
Brought to you by Capital One, where you can open a savings account in about 5 minutes and earn 5 times the national average. Just imagine, 5 times more savings toward that overdue home addition, maybe even an addition on that addition. This is banking reimagined. What's in Your Wallet? Capital One, N.A. Member FDIC.